Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out. And when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. And we have another full weekend of college baseball to talk about. SEC play started, Big 12 play started, Pac-12 play started, ACC, Big 10, they're all still going strong. And so there was a lot of action around the country, and we're going to get to it here on the podcast. We're going to talk about that opening weekend of SEC play. Going to talk about Florida State's huge week as they go 4-0 against Florida and Miami in dominating fashion. Texas Tech and Oklahoma State highlighted the start of Big 12 play. We'll get to that, as did a couple big series out in the Pac-12. Like I said, we'll get to all of that here today on the Baseball America podcast, the Baseball America College podcast specifically, which is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, we're here. It's a sunny Monday here in Durham. We got a lot to get to. And we're going to start with 4-0 Fairfield, the Metro Atlantic Athletic Conference also open play this weekend, and Fairfield, the Stags, 4-0 against Canisius.
Look, I mean, if listeners had read my Metro Atlantic preview, they would not have been shocked by this development. Canisius is talented. They can pitch, man. This is not a huge surprise to me. I think there's a lot of assumption out there that Canisius is a name people recognize, and Canisius is, you know, as much of a brand name as exists in the Metro Atlantic as far as baseball goes. But Fairfield is my team to beat, and so I'm walking with a little extra swagger this morning that seeing what my Stags were able to do against the Golden Griffins over the weekend.
As you should. All right. The SEC, they opened conference play this weekend as well, and it was a pretty full weekend of baseball in the SEC. I'm just going to run through some of the headlines here, Joe, and then we can take it wherever we want it. Jack Leiter, He threw a no-hitter on Saturday for Vanderbilt against South Carolina. It's Vanderbilt's first no-hitter in like a year and a half. Kamar Rocker, of course, threw one in Super Regionals against Duke in 2019. And oh, by the way, he was excellent against South Carolina as well. Combined, they struck out 30 batters in their two games. Vanderbilt wins the series. South Carolina wins on Sunday. Stop me if you heard that before. Alabama stunned Arkansas on Friday night, handed the Hogs their worst loss in Baum Walker Stadium this century, maybe longer. I stopped looking after I got to 2000. But the Hogs come back and they win the series. Mississippi State kept rolling. They win their series in Baton Rouge. Florida, Ole Miss sweep A&M and Auburn, respectively. Tennessee beats Georgia in a tight series in Athens. And Kentucky wins its series at home against Missouri. Joe, take that where you will.
I like your Missouri there. That's someone who lived not far from Missouri for a little while in the recent past. That hits home right there.
Mizzou's a little passe, I feel like. You know, everyone says Mizzou now. Let's go to Missouri.
Yeah, that's sounds like my grandmother. My grandmother, who lived in the state, would say Missouri. And she used to say that, you know, if you're in St. Louis or if you're in Kansas City, it's Missouri. Everywhere in between, it's Missouri. That was her way of looking at it. So straight from the mouth of a Missouri resident. I think I know you have thoughts on this, but one of the more fascinating things is, you know, Vanderbilt in that series obviously gets incredible pitching on the first two games. And, you know, I wrote about this in the aftermath of Jack Leiter's no-hitter, just kind of at the end of that piece, which was mostly just about his performance. But I threw like a couple little things in at the end. And one of which is that I think there are a lot of comparisons to be made between the Leiter no-hitter and the Rocker no-hitter in terms of the stakes were much greater for the Rocker no-hitter, right? Super regional, like nobody's going to dispute that.
However, elimination game too for Vanderbilt.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So obviously you set the stakes aside, but there were some similarities, I think, in terms of the way Leiter in this case dominated with one pitch in the same way Rocker did. It was the breaking ball with Rocker in that game against Duke. It was the fastball for Leiter against South Carolina. I also think this is potentially kind of a game where Jack Leiter is a little more known because he's Al Leiter's kid and because he plays in the same team as Kamar Rocker, let's be honest. But I think this is maybe a little bit of a coming out party for him in the same way that it was for Rocker, where it's maybe he was a name that if you really follow the draft, or you obviously if you follow college baseball, but if you really follow the draft, you've probably known of that name and you knew of Rocker in 2019, but it wasn't until the no-hitter maybe that you knew exactly what was up with Kamar Rocker. And now Leiter has his own highlight reel that's going to run for the rest of the season, all the way through the postseason, and will be shown a million times on the MLB draft broadcast when that comes around in July. So I thought it was kind of interesting. I think there are some parallels with the way they did it and also with what might come from this point moving forward. I also think it's, you know, in a sport, I've said this before, this is not new ground, and anyone that understands the sport will inherently know this, but in a sport that's set up to allow teams that win two out of three to have success, like Vanderbilt is in very good shape when it comes to that. They have the two top college pitching prospects, and now those two guys also seem like they might just be the two best pitchers in the sport. That can be debated, but they're certainly two in the discussion. That's clear. But then on Sundays, like Vanderbilt still has some questions on the mound, and that's kind of interesting. And who knows when that'll come back to bite them, because if Rocker and Leiter are as good as they were this weekend, it won't matter a ton. But there is an opportunity where that comes back, or in a situation where that comes back to bite them. So that will be a development to watch as it goes forward, because, you know, Rocker and Leiter are not always going to be as good as they were this past weekend. And so, you know, do we see that kind of rear its head in SEC play? Do they get it figured out? That's certainly on the table. There's enough talent on this pitching staff. Maybe they get it figured out. But it is really fascinating to see how good they pitched the first 2 days. And then the last couple Sundays in particular, they've kind of floundered a little bit looking to find a third guy to finish it off.
Yeah, Vanderbilt's going to lose a series at some point this year. And it's going to be because one or both of them did not, you know, do what they, like the superhuman feats that they have been doing for the last the last month now. It's incredibly impressive what Jack Leiter did. SEC no hitters are rare. Casey Mize threw the last one, in SEC play. Prior to that, there was a pitcher for A&M that did it, whose name is escaping me. And if you go back before that one, it had been like, I want to say like 15 years before, like in between SEC no hitters and SEC play. We'd have to fact check that, but it is a rare thing to do. And Jack Leiter is keeping very good company by having done this in SEC play, let alone his SEC debut. And I think that's what stands out to me the most here is that, yes, it's a little wonky that this was his SEC debut because, last season he didn't get a chance to play an SEC game, but this was his debut, and what a debut it was. It couldn't have gone any better. I mean, I guess it could have gone slightly better if he hadn't walked the leadoff hitter, but that was the only blemish. He walked the leadoff hitter and then retired 27 straight, 16 by strikeout. Just what a remarkable performance. And this is against an okay hitting South Carolina team. I'm not quite sure how good of a hitting South Carolina team this is, just because over the last two weekends, they've had to play at Oklahoma State and at Vanderbilt, and those are two of the better pitching teams in the country. So my view of what the Gamecocks hitters are is being colored, or not Oklahoma State, Texas. Got that confused. But anyway, Texas, one of the better pitching teams in the country too. And it's been on the road, and that's just coloring my view of what South Carolina hitters are right now. And oh, by the way, they go home next weekend, but they go home to play Florida. So, it's another premium pitching outfit that they're going to have to face. And so, I don't know specifically how good the South Carolina offense is, but I know it's a solid one. I think I know that. And Leiter and Rocker were outstanding against it. But yeah, I mean, at some point, Vanderbilt needs to find some answers behind those guys, I think. They covered the first 18 innings of this series with Rocker, Leiter, and newfound closer Luke Murphy. That's great if you can do that. But there will be other times that they have to find other answers. And right now, as it's gone the last 2 weeks, they haven't really found those answers outside of the games that Rocker and Leiter start. I mean, the talent's there. I'm not going to be too terribly worried about it. But if one of those guys falters at a bad time, they're going to be fighting it a little bit. If you go back to 2019, like I said, that was an elimination game for Vanderbilt because Vanderbilt lost the first game against Duke at home in a super regional. If they do that this year, they're going to feel great again, having Leiter to follow. But the other team's going to feel a lot better about day three than I think Duke did in 2019.
Cleaning up the thought you had there, because I couldn't come up with his name at the time either. Kyle Simons was the guy's name. That was against Vanderbilt, by the way. It was in 2016, and I have a little connection to that game, actually. So in 2016, I was living in Houston, and that was my first season truly covering college baseball from start to finish. I had done some little work here and there on college baseball. I still was watching just about as much college baseball as I do now, frankly. So I was still on top of it, but I wasn't writing as much yet. But so 2016 is my first season really being knee deep in it. And so I was, that weekend comes, and A&M from where I lived, cause I lived in a part of Houston that was closer to College Station than other parts. So, I could get to College Station in less than an hour and a half. And thanks to the newly opened toll road by which I lived. So that made it a little bit quicker, but anyhow, so I had an opportunity. That Sunday game comes, and I had been somewhere else that weekend, or maybe I hadn't been anywhere that weekend. So I was kind of getting itchy towards the end of the weekend. And A&M at the time was still a very new Bluebell Park, still new in the grand scheme of things, but just a few years old at that point. And so, nice big press. So it's one of the places where, I'm sure I could have reached out to Thomas Dick, their SID, and gotten, made sure there was room for me in the press box and gone. And I thought about kind of on a whim, just going to that Sunday game. And then I didn't, and it turns out it was a no hitter. So, had things maybe gone a little bit, had my mind just been in a different place when I got up that Sunday morning, maybe I end up at that game and end up at that no hitter. And I, you know, I get to see it live, but, I did not. And, that's, you know, that's the way it goes. Sometimes you miss out on stuff like that. But, I guarantee you, had I been at that game, I would not have forgotten Kyle Simon's name. I can tell you that much.
It is, it's kind of crazy how things go. It was either Scherzer or Strasburg threw a no-hitter on the final day of the regular season for the Nationals several years ago. And I happened to be in D.C. at the time with my friend. And we talked about, like, oh, we could go to the Nats game today. And then we didn't. And then that happened. And yeah, it's the would-haves, could-haves, should-haves that, that come to define no-hitter viewing experiences sometimes. All right, so we're going to talk more about the SEC opening weekend in a minute here, but first, check this out. All right, Joe, we talked about Vanderbilt beating South Carolina, strong series win for the Commodores, and of course about Jack Leiter's no-hitter there. The other big story from the weekend for me was Alabama and Arkansas. We talked about this on the preview podcast. I was very interested in the series, and I think what happened on the field bore out why I was so interested. It started with a bang as Alabama upset Arkansas 16-1 on Friday night. Like I said, that was the worst loss in Baumwalker Stadium this century. And I mean, it was a strange game from the jump, really. Alabama put 10 runs on the board in the second inning, never looked back. We talked a lot about how Arkansas dug itself holes early in games, early in game one of series throughout this this season, but they had always been able to come back. Well, they finally found a hole they couldn't dig out of. But then the Razorbacks came back with a 9-1 win on Saturday. That surprised exactly nobody, I assume. You punch the number one team in the mouth. You expect them to respond. That's exactly what happened on Saturday. And then on Sunday, it was a good rubber game. That Arkansas did just enough offensively to win 3-1. Alabama got the tying run to the plate in the ninth inning, but could not bring it home. And as a result, Arkansas remains number one in the top 25 with another series win. Alabama takes the series loss, but to my mind anyway, really validated everything we had said about the Tide coming into the season.
Yeah, totally agree. And there's a reason why we didn't really move Alabama in the rankings, because that was probably about the expected result. Now, you know, winning a game by scoring 16 runs was probably not something that we would have predicted, although we did talk a little bit about how, you know, Arkansas's pitching staff just kind of has these blips. And, you know, I think if you're Arkansas, like you just kind of saw what can happen, you know, like that is very much a result on the table for Arkansas this season with what we've seen from them. They just have these blips where they'll have games where they just struggle to get folks out. And it's not even like the same guys they're running out there, you know, like it's like a different guy every time sometimes, you know, so that is on the table as a result for Arkansas. And that, I think that will always make, as much as I like most of what Arkansas has brought to the table, I certainly like the results. You know, I think that gives me a little bit of pause about them, just knowing that is in there, you know, and probably will be for the remainder of the season. So that was just kind of a little bit of a surprising result in some ways, but not so much in others. But yeah, Alabama was right there. You know, that they obviously had the middle game where Arkansas kind of punched back, if you will. And that third game was just a real tight, well-played Sunday game. I can't ask for a lot more on a Sunday than that game, because it was well-played and relatively low scoring. And so that was good to see that series end on that kind of note. But you know, I think Alabama is who we thought they were, you know, to quote an often used phrase. And if, you know, there's obviously a lot of kind of mystery about what's going on with Connor Prelip and what we might or might not see from him moving forward, but this pitching staff has really done a nice job keeping them above water without him, you know, with Tyler Rasm and Dylan Smith and Antoine John and the rotation all all lifting some heavy loads. And so if Prelip comes back and he's healthy, they feel even better about that unit. I think that's a really good starting rotation if he's back. And it's pretty solid as it is. It's going to keep them in games. And we obviously saw the ceiling with the offense on what they did on Friday night. So Alabama, very good team. You know, I'm happy that we've stuck with them early on, and you know, they haven't moved a lot because they really have yet to blow us away with a weekend, but they've done exactly what we expected they would do. And this weekend was more of the same.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. I'm very interested this weekend. Ole Miss goes to Tuscaloosa. What's going to happen there? Getting a team like that at home is important for the Tide here as they kind of try and find their footing a little bit in SEC play. But what they did on Friday night was really significant. And I think that if you had been skeptical of what we'd said about Alabama previously, or hadn't paid them much mind at all, I think that probably woke you up to just what the Tide has been building there in what is now Brad Bohannon's fourth season as head coach. Mississippi State, they go 2-1 in Baton Rouge. Joe, honestly, this is a big rivalry. We ranked it really high when we ranked college baseball rivalries. It lacked a little something, I think, basically just because LSU didn't have a number next to its name for us. The games delivered pretty well, but they delivered in pretty much the exact way I would have expected them to. They were low scoring because Mississippi State pitches really well. LSU's pitching rose to the occasion. And, you know, it was a good, well-played series. Did we learn anything about either of these teams, though?
No, I actually don't think so. Like, I didn't watch them. I didn't go through them with a fine-tooth comb as if you or I were a Mississippi State or LSU beat writer, you know, right? Those guys could probably tell you very specific things they saw that developed along the way. Like, if you and I did those jobs, it'd probably be a little different story. But, you know, big, big picture here, which is what you and I are ultimately doing, I don't know that we really learned anything, because you're right. Mississippi State did what it has done all season, where it just kind of is able to – it's got talented guys in the rotation, sure. And if those guys really, you know, give them what they're looking for, great. But if they don't, like, they can just throw numbers at you. And that's been one of the bigger developments in that team all season. We saw it again against LSU. And you know, some of the series not having the pop that it would normally have is, you know, LSU hasn't been – a vintage version of LSU this season. And they played well in the series. That effort wins a lot of games, but Mississippi State has just been so good so far this season and kind of, you know, toughing out some of these kinds of games. And, I think the one thing that if you talked to us before the season, maybe not going into the series, knowing what we knew through 4 weeks going into the fifth week, but before the season, I think I would have been a little more surprised at you know, the way that Mississippi State was able to kind of just continue to chip away at Jaden Hill, and the way Jaden Hill wasn't really able to impose his will. He threw the ball well. His numbers, I wrote this in the recap after Friday night, like, he threw the ball well, and his numbers, because he ended up giving up some runs kind of at the end of his outing, don't really reflect how well he pitched. But also, you know, for a guy who's one of the better arms in college baseball, like, he's just not been dominant, I guess, in the way that we would have expected. And even if you kind of excuse the Oral Roberts outing, which I know is too easy to do, but also, you know, like, that was just clearly a terrible day for him at the ballpark. Even if you throw that out, though, there just hasn't been the dominance that I think we expected to see from him, and at the very least in spurts. And so I think at the beginning of the year, I would have been a little bit surprised that, oh, you know, Mississippi State was really able to really take it to Jaden Hill late in that outing. And that was a little bit of a surprise. But other than that, I mean, you're right. I think this series went to form. And I think that speaks well on what we expect of Mississippi State, that they go to Baton Rouge and win 2-3 and pitch really well. And we come out of it going like, yeah, okay. Yeah. That was exactly what we expected there.
Yeah. I think maybe the biggest thing I learned was Will Bednar is getting close to being all the way back. He was in start the season healthy, but he threw 5 really good innings in the Saturday game. And, you know, as he continues to get lengthened out a little bit, I mean, that's looking really good there for the Bulldogs behind Christian McLeod on Friday night. Sarantola still is looking to get fully strained out as a third starter. They've used Jackson Fritzo at times this season when they didn't have Bednar. I mean, that's probably still an option at some point if they need it. And, Mississippi State's going to have one of the better rotations in the country, potentially one of the absolute best. And the depth in the bullpen is incredible. And all the rest of it, it was a really good weekend for Mississippi State. And now that sets up a number one versus number two next weekend in Starkville, as Arkansas is headed there. This will be the 14th time in the 40-year history of the Baseball America Top 25 that the top two teams have faced off in the regular season. So very excited about that one next weekend, and we will talk plenty more about that on the Thursday preview podcast.
Yeah, do you think we'll preview that one?
I have a hunch that might spend a little bit of time on that this week.
Okay, all right, fair enough. I guess I understand.
Before we move on from the SEC, I know this has been a lot of SEC talk. Joe, this was opening weekend. It was exciting that there was conference baseball in the SEC, but I found it not as exciting as maybe I have in years past. And I think that's because, number one, the series, there were only two rubber games. And, just for the most part, the series were all decided pretty easily. Arkansas and Alabama played a rubber game, as did Tennessee and Georgia. But every team, there were seven series. Six of them involved at least one ranked team. And in all six of those series, the higher ranked team won the series. And in the other one, Kentucky was at home against Mizzou. Kentucky wins that series. And not only are they the home team, but Mizzou is the team that's the only team that's under 500 in the SEC. So also not an upset. So no upsets this weekend. And then it just feels like the SEC is as stratified as it's been since 2016. I think there's a very clear cut top of the conference. They're the top five teams of the country. The middle of the class is pretty well established. We're ranking three other teams, 16 through 23. Throw Georgia and LSU into that mix. Neither one of them is too terribly far out of the top 25 now. And then the four teams at the bottom, Auburn and A&M got swept this weekend. Mizzou, as mentioned, under 500 overall. And Kentucky has a decent record, but also has a home series loss to Ball State. Kentucky's going to have to prove it a little bit after where they've been the last couple of years, and they haven't done that yet. All of those four teams will have a chance to move into the middle tier as the season continues. That the SEC provides plenty of chances, but to this point, those are the four worst teams in the conference. And when we present a projected field of 64 this week, they are not going to be in it. So, right now I just feel like at least after 5 weeks of the season, with the SEC having what seems to me like pretty clear cut tiers, it's, maybe one team will move here and there, maybe Tennessee goes on a run and pushes into that top tier. I don't know, but like right now it just seems like this is the way it is. And, until those top teams play each other, upsets are less likely.
What's so funny about that is I didn't, maybe on a previous podcast I had said it, but I meant to say it in the weekend preview podcast last week and just didn't because it, got away from me there. But, I was going to kind of sarcastically say like a thank you to all those conferences starting conference play, because I'm really tired of looking on the ESPN app and like all of my choices of the games to watch are just a bunch of ACC series of teams that I've already watched four or five times this year. And so it was going to be nice to have a little bit of variety. The funny thing is, we had that this weekend, and sure, the Pac-12 makes it a little bit tougher because they don't have their streaming games. You have to like go directly to the site, and find the stream. And, it's hard to, you can't really do it on a smart TV as easily as you can with an ESPN app or what have you. But So we had that variety this weekend, and yet, you know, we get to Sunday and like I'm choosing between ACC series again, because not only are you correct, and also, you know, I watched Arkansas Alabama, but that game was a later start. So like there was a window there at the beginning where they're just, you know, I was looking for other stuff. So that created part of the issue too. But, you know, the SEC series were a decent number of series that weren't really particularly competitive. And, you know, we had the Florida A&M series get over a day early, and, you know, most of the series were just weren't really popping in that way. And so there I was after weeks of kind of looking forward to this weekend as being able to choose from some different stuff. And here I was just cycling through a bunch of ACC series again, because those were the series that still seemed the most interesting. So that will change. I assume there will be some change in that as time goes on. But, you know, I was just surprised by how, I don't want to undersell this, but I was just surprised by how not compelling so much of what the SEC provided through one weekend really, really was. Not that there weren't some interesting things happening on a micro level, but in terms of big picture things, you're right. It wasn't the opening weekend that really would get you super excited about SEC baseball being back. We are excited about SEC baseball being back. Do not get us wrong, listener. However, it was not an opening weekend to remember, I don't think.
Yeah, and one thing before we move on, I use the shorthand of 2016, but not everyone is going to remember the 2016 season, you know, specifics perfectly well. So in that season, the SEC had 7 hosts in regionals. That was a record, but it didn't get a single other team into the tournament, which was strange to say the least. So, you know, if you're, I don't think that there are going to just be 7 regional hosts and nothing else. Like, I think that, you know, they have 5, 6, maybe 7 hosts. But like there should be a couple other teams that get into the into regionals this year, unlike in 2016. But like then, I think there's a clear cut top of the conference and a clear cut bottom of the conference. You know, so we'll see if that changes later. But for now, that's the way I see it.
The other thing that probably this means, if we are seeing a redux of 2016, is that congratulations to Pac-12 champion Utah. That's going to be a big deal. Like, that's going to be surprising. I don't think people are going to see that coming. That was, but here we are. If we're going to do 2016 all over again, congrats to Utah. Congrats to BC on getting to a super regional, and congrats to UC Santa Barbara on going to Omaha.
Well, you know, 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
That was a fun, that was at 2016. That was a fun season for a lot of different, it was weird in the SEC. Like I get that. And it was part of the reason Utah won the Pac-12 is because it was kind of one of those apocalyptic years on the West Coast where everyone goes, what's wrong with the West? You know? But it
was actually true that year.
For sure. Like there was reason to be saying that for sure. But it was a lot. I remember that season being a lot of fun overall. I mean, obviously it ends with Coastal winning a national title. So, you know, that's obviously, I guess, exhibit A of that.
All right, let's move on here. Let's go to one of those ACC series that you were so excited about, except this one, it was the least competitive of the group. Florida State went to Miami and absolutely trounced the Canes. They swept the series in Miami for the first time since 2002. None of the games were close. And if you throw in their win on Tuesday against Florida, they outscored their rivals 44-4 on the week. The closest game after 5 innings of any of those 4 games was Saturday's win in Miami. And, you know, midway through the game, Florida State was already up 4 runs. In many cases throughout this week, they were up that many runs after the first or the second inning. They never trailed all week. It was a really, really remarkable week. It was not just the best week of any team in the country had this week. It was the best week any team in the country has had all season long. And with that, Florida State vaults back into the top 25 at number 15. And you know, this is the team we signed up for. I think it doesn't look like the team we signed up for when we ranked them very highly in the top 10 in the preseason. Elijah Cabell still not hitting. Reese Albert is hurt. you know, there are some things offensively just are a little weird as a result, but this is the team we signed up for the most part.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, that, my goodness, talk about, and you know, you and I had this conversation when we were talking top 25 last night that, you know, it's funny how the season, this is one of the most fascinating things for me year after year. And it's something that I didn't appreciate before I started having to, you know, work on a top 25 every week, because one thing you have to evaluate when you work on a top 25 every week, because not a lot of people know when you have a top 25, like, I don't know, people don't understand, like, you have to have 25 teams, right? So like they don't get that. So you have to evaluate these resumes every single week. And so I think that has helped me do a good job of kind of reevaluating what we actually know about a team week after week, where I think it's really easy if you don't do that. You know, we bring Florida State back in, and yes, you maybe know that they trounced Miami, but they bring Florida State back in pretty quickly after they came out just a few weeks. That's a pretty quick bounce back. But then I always think it's fascinating to take a step back and think about why that is. And it's not just what they've done this week. It's that, okay, we were pretty down on them when they got swept by Pitt. And would they have liked to have won at least a game in that series? Sure. But we now know a lot more about what Pitt is. And so suddenly it starts to look like, okay, we were probably a little bit harsh on Florida State. Like, let's kind of make amends here a little bit, knowing what we know now. It was the right decision to make at the time, knowing what we knew then. And so you're not just reevaluating the team based on what you've seen from them in that window. You're also reevaluating based on what everything else is happening around them. And that's just something I didn't think about a lot before I started having to do this job, where I'm looking at these resumes day after day after day. But there's really not much else to say in terms of what we saw on the field here. Like, every facet, Florida State was just better than Miami. And I know it's easy to say, because when a team gets beat badly, it's always going to look bad. But Miami was just really sloppy, in addition to not playing well. Like, it wasn't just that they had no answers on either side. It was also that they kicked the ball around. I think it was 7 errors in the first 2 games and 8 total for the weekend. So it was just not a pretty brand of baseball either. And so Miami's got a lot of, we still rank them because, like, their resume is a weird one, but it still has some stuff on it.
Most confusing resume in the country.
Yeah. I think this is indicative of what we're going to see in the ACC all year. Like, unfortunately for us, we're going to have to spend many a Sunday night trying to figure out what to do with all these ACC teams, because the ACC gave us the tough hand of giving us ACC series basically every single weekend from week 2 on. So that's going to make it even more difficult as time goes on. But Miami's just, they've got a lot of questions to answer. And we've been talking about some of these questions since the beginning, right? I mean, the questions like, what is the bullpen beyond Carson Palmquist? And is, you know, Daniel Fetterman and 2 freshmen, is that a starting rotation that's going to be able to get it done in big games? And offensively, like, who are the new stars that are going to step up around Adrian Del Castillo and Alex Terrell? And that was under the assumption those 2 guys would really be hitting like we expected them to. So it's like all of the same questions we had from the beginning are still sitting there unanswered, and they have time to answer them. That's certainly still true. But man, this was getting punched in the mouth more so than I think anything I've seen in a long, long time.
Yeah. And, you know, for Florida State, you know, I think that, you know, they've found some answers offensively. Robbie Martin started the year 8 for 34 without an extra base hit over the first 3 weeks. And, you know, he's gotten it going. That's been very important. Reese Albert is out injured. Getting him back will be important, but they found some other guys to step up. Matt Nelson has 7 home runs this year. You know, that's been important. They threw the pitchers into the lineup, the pitchers meaning Wyatt Kroll and Parker Messick most notably, but also Davis Hare has gotten some at-bats. And, you know, that's worked in a pretty significant way, especially in the case of Messick. I don't know how long that's going to work for. Maybe those guys just do end up being good hitters. They have that in them. They've, you know, it wasn't just a spur of the moment, like, let's see what the pitchers have. Those are guys with two-way talent. But they're also players that there is no scouting report for yet. And like, as a book gets written about Parker Messick, the hitter, will he be able to make the adjustments? Like, we'll have to wait and see on that. But for now, it's given them a lift. And, you know, that's all really significant. And, you know, the Florida State pitching staff has impressed me. Messick has really locked in on Friday nights. They've decided they're going with Bryce Hubart, another second-year freshman, on Saturdays. That has worked pretty well. He was a little wild against Miami, but he got out of all the jams he got himself into. And then Connor Grady continues to just be a steady Eddie on Sunday for them to round out the rotation. And then they have a very veteran lead in bullpen. A lot of names that you know, if you've been paying attention to Florida State baseball over the last few years, Clayton Kwiatkowski, Jonas Scolaro, Chase Haney, Hunter Perdue's a little bit of the new kid on the block, but he's also a junior college transfer. So this is like year four of college baseball for him. And you know, as a result, like it runs pretty deep. They can feel pretty good about all those guys. And oh, by the way, Carson Montgomery, who was the top ranked player in the country to make it to college last year, he's your midweek starter, and that's working pretty well for them too. So I really like what they have on the mound. And if this offense, which averaged 11 runs this week, if that's here to stay, you know, and anything close to that, this is going to be a team that can compete with anyone in the ACC and looks like an Omaha threat.
Man, you said that Mike Martin Jr. didn't just randomly start putting the pitchers in the lineup to see what happens. Man, I wish he had. Like, that would be so much fun. If like he just so frustrated by the offense, he just like looks to its right, look to his right, and like Parker Messick is charting pitches, and he's like, "All right, get up there. Hey, let's see what you got." And then the next guy in line is like Wyatt Correll. He's like, "All right, get up there." Like that's some Wayne Graham stuff. For those who don't know, Wayne Graham, the former Rice coach, like you know, he was someone who, you know, and I guess to his credit, because like, you know, he was a very successful coach. Like he has no hesitations, like making pitching changes in the middle of at bats when that wasn't a thing. Like now that's actually like a strategy sometimes you see employed. Like he would do that if he just didn't like the first two pitches he saw a guy throw. He would put pinch hitters in like 0-2 counts. If like the guy who was up the plate took two strikes he didn't like. You know, he would put in a pitcher who hadn't thrown in weeks because he was just giving a guy a shot, or because he was frustrated with the guys he was normally using. Like, so I would not have put it past Wayne Graham to do something like that. Like get a guy out of the dugout who hasn't hit since high school 4 years ago and just give him regular at bats, just kind of because he's angry at the guys he normally has up there. But unfortunately, you're right. That is not the case we are seeing right now, but boy, would that be fun.
That's taken from a different time, Wayne Graham. All right, let's move on here to the Big 12 highlight. They only played two conference series this weekend. Texas wins a series at Baylor and the other, but we're going to talk here about Texas Tech and Oklahoma State. Texas Tech wins the series, went down to the absolute wire. The team split the first two games. Tech got a lead going into the ninth inning on Sunday. Oklahoma State loads the bases, only gets one run. They needed two to tie the game in the ninth inning. So Texas Tech comes out with the series win. When these two teams play, they are always close series. You know, the last time it happened, it was the 2019 Lubbock Super Regional. That also went down to the wire or thereabouts. And several other times in recent years when these two teams have played, they've played some really entertaining series. This edition was more of the same. And yet again, Texas Tech wins in Lubbock. We talked coming into this about how, you know, Oklahoma State really needed to win this series to prove themselves as Big 12 contenders in the race. I don't know. Coming out of it, like, they acquitted themselves pretty well. It's still a series loss. They still now have a lot of ground to make up. Just already in the Big 12, and to think Texas Tech is going to drop too many games, like that's probably not happening. But I do come out of this feeling better about Oklahoma State than I might have expected. Certainly better this week than last week. in that series loss at home to Vanderbilt.
Yeah, I agree. I think, we talked about teams don't go to Lubbock and really have a lot of success. So through that lens, they obviously acquitted themselves well. I also think the way in which they did it, where I think there was still, even though I wrote a couple weeks ago about how Oklahoma State is really a pitching forward outfit, at least to this point of the season, I think there was still some reasonable skepticism about, okay, you've done that against the teams you've played, but what happens when you go to a place like Lubbock? And they really did a pretty nice job, I think, limiting the offense there. And I guess we could maybe have like a semantic discussion about how good this Tech offense is versus previous versions and da 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 da. But what I will tell you is that, you look at the Tech lineup and it does have some of the hallmarks of Tech lineups we've seen in the past, where it's got guys who are going to steal bases and kind of make things happen, kind of gritty players. It has a big bopper in the middle of the order with a familiar last name in Jace Young, which, by the way, I don't really think I'd fully internalized just how good he's been so far this season. He's putting up
it's ridiculous.
He's putting up numbers like his brother, right? And that's a really high bar to clear. And he's really doing it, maybe you know better than I, but Josh Young put up good numbers from the jump at Texas Tech. But if we're just saying 2020 didn't happen with Jace Young, in calling this his freshman year, I think he's probably on a better pace than what Josh was. Now, that's not quite a apples to apples, because 2020 did happen and Jace Young has now had more than a year in this program. So it's not an easy comparison to make, but point being, he's putting up absurd numbers. He looks like a bona fide star. So that's been a huge development for Texas Tech. But by and large, I think Oklahoma State feels good about the way they were able to compete there. And for Texas Tech, I liked the fact that, we saw, their pitching staff come in and, Patrick Monteverde threw really well again. It's clear at this point, as unorthodox as it is, the way that he has arrived at Texas Tech as their steadiest starter, it seems pretty clear that this is not a fluke. Now, he's probably not going to pitch this well the rest of the year, because then he would be Big 12 pitcher of the year probably. But he is clearly good enough to get this done. So that has been a big thing. You also had to like what you saw from Brandon Birdsall, who's been a little more up and down this season. But, in a loss on Friday, he was really excellent. Had he not been opposing Parker Scott, who is even better, he wins that game for Texas Tech more often than not. So I also kind of liked some of what I saw with Texas Tech on the mound. I wish we could – that's a series, as much as there were a lot of series this weekend where I was kind of that's a series I wish we could run back, because I thought it was really intriguing. I did think we learned some things about these teams, and I'd like to see three more games.
Yeah, it was everything that you could have wanted from this series. And I fear that this might have been the Big 12 series of the year, and it's already come and gone. We'll see what happens when Texas plays either of these two teams. And I'm not writing off TCU, but I think I've made it clear that I'm a little down on where the Frogs are versus where I thought they might be coming into the year. But a great start to the Big 12 play. Tech. It just feels a little ho-hum. Of course they found Patrick Monteverde. Why wouldn't they have found that? And their junior college transfer has become a reliable Friday night starter. Of course. And Chase Young is hitting, and so is Drew Baker. And of course all of these things are happening. And, but it is very impressive what Texas Tech is doing. And more impressive than that is the fact that I'm being so of course Texas Tech did this. What Tim Tadlock has built there, we talk about it a lot, but it's deserved. I mean, this is a team that has become the Big 12's behemoth. And, if you go to the pre-Tim Tadlock era, it has one conference title in its history. So it's very impressive what they're doing. And this weekend was more of the same, but more of the same for the Red Raiders is a really high level. And this is looking like another Omaha outfit, I would say.
Indeed. Yeah. I will scream that from the rooftops. I'm glad you bring it up again. Texas Tech for much of, the 21st century has been and also ran in the Big 12. They would have little moments where they'd pop up and they'd put good teams in the field, but they had a little bit of a heyday under Larry Hayes, who was the coach in Lubbock for a long time and did a really good job. He's a legendary coach there and deservedly so. And they had a really good run in the late 90s and the early days of the Big 12, late 90s, early 2000s, where they were one of the best teams in the country. I think they were even number one in the country at some point in some polls. I don't know if it was BA, but for there in the late 90s. And a lot of talented players came through there. They won a lot of games. But then it was a pretty narrow span of years, and they went kind of back to being a team that was good but not great. And then, of course, they, as time went on, they became, you know, really mediocre until Tim Tadlock got there. So doing it in Lubbock is not an easy thing to do. You know, it is out there in West Texas. They're not super close to any of the big recruiting hotbeds. You know, they don't have the coast or, you know, the mountains or a big city to recruit to. Like, they're working with a lot of what you would think would be disadvantages from the very beginning. And in the face of that, it has turned into far and away, not even close, the most consistent program in the Big 12. It's absolutely incredible.
They were not number one. They have never been ranked number one in the Baseball America Top 25. We'll see. Maybe this year. We've already had two first time number ones. Maybe we got room for a third. We'll see. All right, let's move on to the Pac-12, which opened conference play. And the big series there was Arizona going to UCLA, and then Arizona State going to Oregon was the undercard to that. And those series both turned out to be pretty interesting. The home teams won them both, so that's UCLA knocking off Arizona, Oregon beating Arizona State. I was pretty down on UCLA a week ago after they lost to Cal Poly. They responded in a big way back at Jackie Robinson Stadium, facing the best offense, probably the best offense in the country. And their pitching staff, you know, definitely rose to the occasion and held the Wildcats in check. That was impressive. And then up the coast in Oregon, Oregon continues to roll. They're pitching well. They're hitting well. Arizona State played well in that series. And what Arizona State is doing, it continues to be very impressive. They continue not to be in the top 25, just on the edge again. Can't bring a team in when they lose a conference series. But, you know, considering what they've gone through, losing three of their better pitchers to injury for the season, you know, they're still rolling right along, and they're continuing to do this more on the pitching side than on the offensive side. They're a fine offensive team, but the pitching, especially when you consider the context, has really been impressive. So, Joe, I'll let you go wherever you want with this, whether that's UCLA or whether that's Oregon or somewhere else. But you know, let's dive into this Pac-12.
Yeah, with UCLA, like, it's interesting because we're viewing them through the context, and understandably and rightfully so, it's not a criticism of us. We're viewing them through the context of, this was a team we had number two in the country coming into the season, and we thought was closer to Florida than closer to, say, Texas Tech. And so through that lens, they have been really inconsistent and a little bit disappointing. And that's the only context through which we can fairly view them, right? But let's say we erased our brains like a Men in Black style, you know, and we just kind of viewed this team, and we viewed them through, you know, it's a spectrum of you're trying to get better and you're trying to work towards the postseason. If that's the case, what we saw this past weekend was a big step in the right direction, because you're right in that they did mostly limit the Arizona offense. You know, Arizona had, I guess, 10 hits in the middle game and scored 7 runs and hit a few home runs. And I think that Arizona's a good team. Like, that's just going to happen. But the Friday game was a quintessential UCLA Friday win, where, you know, Zach Pettway gives them 5 shutout innings. He looks more like himself than he has at any point so far this season. So perhaps he's rounding into form. You know, the bullpen holds on, you know, and then they win the game on a bases loaded walk in the bottom of the 9th inning and kind of just.
Can we talk about that for a second? Jack Philby drew that walk. Jack Philby, as of Friday night, I should pull this up here in a second. He'd walked 19 times already this year. He's hitting like 180. Like, yeah. I don't know what it is about him, but like, for some reason, pitchers don't want to throw strikes to a guy who doesn't really strike you as a power threat. I don't know what that is. It's outstanding plate discipline from Philby's perspective, but he is now hitting 152 on the season. Still just the 19 walks in 30. He's had 33 at bats. He has 5 hits and he's 5 for 33, 1 home run, but he has 19 walks. It's one of the craziest things I have found stat-wise this season.
That is really interesting. Maybe I'll make a note to go back and watch all of his at-bats, because there are other guys you see that have like just absurd walk numbers, but then they also have like fairly high strikeout numbers. And it's like,
okay, he's only struck out five times.
Right. Yeah. Like, cause with some guys, it's like, okay, maybe you should be swinging the bat a little more often.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a passive thing here. Like it's an actual, just like he knows what it's zone control is what it is.
Yeah. That's incredible. Like that's the thing. He's hitting 152, but like 472 on base, like hit him leadoff. My goodness. Anyway, yes, you're right. So that is correct. I'm glad you drew my attention to that, cause I would probably have glossed over that, but so, you know, it's kind of a typical UCLA win. And then I would even say Sunday was too, where it's like, it's a close game. You know, the pitching isn't quite as good because it's Sunday. And then, you know, late in the game, UCLA just kind of manufactures a bunch of runs, you know, and just puts it on Arizona. And before you know it, you look up and UCLA has run away and they win the series. So, again, through the context of the way we view this team in the postseason, still doesn't look exactly like I think we thought it would look. Understanding that this is a team building towards playing its best baseball in June, I thought this was a really big step for them. So I take a lot of, I won't say a lot, I take a good amount of positive out of this for UCLA, understanding that it still feels like they're working through some things. And on the other series, kudos to Oregon again. Like they, you know, it's this group of guys that we knew were talented. We've said this before, but you know, the fact that arguably the two biggest catalysts for Oregon being where it is right now are Kenyon Yovan and Cullen Kafka, who were two guys who have been known quantities in college baseball, or known talented players anyway, in college baseball for a long time and just hadn't ever really put it together. And then, you know, last year maybe would have been the arrival year, but instead it's this year. And so the fact that it's those guys, and this is not a case of Coach Waz bringing in an entirely new roster and getting it done with a bunch of new faces is kind of fascinating and interesting. And I think probably rewarding for those guys and for this Oregon program, that it's kind of a group of guys that had dealt with some downs in this program and had dealt with struggles, and now they're winning games. And so, you know, you have on this weekend, you know, Kafka continues to, or Yovan continues to hit the ball well, and Kafka has a career day on the mound. And I think it's pretty cool to see this team kind of continues to roll on. And I'm even with you on Arizona State, where I think this is a, you know, I kind of compare it to the 2016 Arizona State team where, and I forget if it was that they'd had guys leave the program or they had injuries or what it was, but the 2016 team for Arizona State, you know, kind of had like 1.5 reliable starters and then just really pieced everything together on the mound after that. And they ended up in a region, and, you know, and Tracy Smith was very open that season about the fact that he thought his team was overachieving a little bit. And I think this team is more talented than that one. And the offense is pretty good, but I do think this team is kind of that team where I think they're a regional team. I think there are going to be times where we kind of look around and go, how are they doing this? Cause I think they're going to steal a series or two. But then there are also just going to be times where they just don't have enough and they, you know, they play well, but just come up a little bit short. And I think that's what happened this weekend. They played pretty well, just ultimately didn't have enough. And I think that's going to kind of be the reality for Arizona State. It's a good team. I think if they're healthy, could have been a team that maybe surprised us a little bit and could have been maybe a great team. I just don't think it's necessarily in the cards, but I think they deserve a lot of credit for fighting the way they have so far.
This went a little under the radar, but USC swept Washington in Seattle, and the Trojans have now won 6 in a row. I basically wrote them off, at least in my head. I don't, probably didn't say it on the podcast, but I basically wrote them off after they got swept in the whatever we're calling the LA College Baseball Classic this year, the tournament that they and UCLA co-hosted. And they not only did they get swept that weekend against Fullerton Pepperdine and UCLA, but they were not competitive. They lost by a combined score of 26-6. The closest game was a 5-0 loss against Fullerton on Friday night. And while Tanner Beebe is pretty good, like, still not great to lose 5-0 on a Friday. They've rebounded though. You know, they swept Nevada at home last weekend. That's a pretty decent Nevada team. I'm not quite sure where they stand in the Mountain West pecking order, but it's a decent Nevada team, I think. And then, you know, I've definitely mentioned before that, you know, Washington is one of those teams that I am just always going to like fall into a trap into thinking the Huskies are probably a little bit better than they are. I certainly did that coming into the season. It looks like they're now 8-9, but anytime you go on the road in the Pac-12 and you sweep a series, especially if you're going to Seattle in March, like that to me seems not insignificant. The Trojans with six straight wins now, they're up to 9-6. I mean, things are looking up there for USC going into a massive series for them next weekend. It's another rivalry with UCLA. They get it at home, so that's important. But you know, I guess what I'm saying here is we cannot write off the Trojans just yet. And this weekend against UCLA just got a lot more interesting.
Indeed. It also, you know, USC is pretty familiar in my mind because they were quite literally the last team I saw in person. I guess them in UCLA, the last team I saw in person in 2020 before things shut down. And you start to look at it and, you know, outside of like last year at this time, Clay Owens was like clobbering the baseball and he still has three home runs. So he's making some contact. But
when you said that, I thought Clay Helton.
Yeah. Clay Helton was out there. They snuck him out there. Like he's not a great athlete anymore, but he can play a little first. So they put him out there and yeah, Clay Helton. Well, look, I mean, the football team has been a little bit disappointing at USC. Nobody would really dispute that. So they had to get a little more value out of Clay Helton's deal.
We're writing this down. We are going to just evaluate at some point in this offseason. You can look for top 25 football coaches as baseball players.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure there are quite a few with some background out there. But, you know, they just thought, you know, we need to get a little more out of Clay Helton. We're not quite getting our value on the football field. Let's see if he can hit a little bit. And turns out he can. So good for him, I guess, you know, at his age, being able to still get out there and get it. So, but you know, so Clay Owens is not hitting like he was last year where he looked like a monster early in the season. But other than that, like it really does look a lot like last year's team in terms of the way guys are performing, in terms of the way things lined up. I know they really like their rotation with Alex Cornwell and Isaac Escueda and Chandler Champlain. So, you know, if you liked last year's team, and there was a decent amount to like, you know, with the way they were playing anyway. This year's team is pretty similar, I think. So we'll have to see. But yeah, I think there's reason to be a little bit optimistic. And I think it's clear, like, I try not to speak in absolutes, especially on such a small number of games. But I think when you look at the way they played last year and, you know, a small sample of this year dealing with early adversity and appearing to be heading in the right direction, like, I think it's clear. You know, that Jason Gill has hit on something there and that something he and his staff are doing there is working. Whether or not we see that the best results of that this year or some year in the future remains to be seen, but it's clear they're pressing some buttons there that are working.
First Pac-12 sweep for the Trojans since 2015.
That's hard to believe when you consider, like, I don't mean to be mean or disparaging here, but when you consider how much teams like Washington State and Utah in particular have struggled. And then, like, you know, there's been years when Oregon,
there was a year, 2 years ago that Washington State won like literally two Pac-12 games.
Right. So when you consider
one of those came against USC.
Yeah. When you consider that, like that is hard to believe. Cause it's not like USC has not been very good. They also haven't like bottomed out the last 5 years or so.
Yeah, so that's an intriguing one to watch. Oregon State won a series against Washington State. Speaking of the Cougars, I don't at this time really know what to make of either of those teams. They both seem intriguing. I think it's safe to say Wazoo is better this year in year two of Brian Green. Probably not a surprise. We had Brian Green on the podcast back in June. He's always very excited, but he seemed to like his team, and he should. Like they are definitely playing pretty well to this point this season. That's a tricky series win for the Beavers that on paper we probably just kind of write off because of what Washington State has been to this point, but is actually probably going to stand up a little bit more impressively as the season goes on. So, you know, Oregon State, it sets up for them pretty well here to start the season well now that they are 2-1. They're at Washington next week. Then they have Utah before they go to Eugene looking for some revenge. So Oregon State fell out of the top 25 last week, but I think we'll be seeing the Beavers again in the rankings before too long. All right, Joe, before we get out of here, I got a quick quick crossover here between football and basketball. So I saw on Twitter last night that David Hale, ESPN writer, looked it up, and he said four schools have won a bowl game and an NCAA men's basketball tournament game this year. Somebody in my mentions said that there was a fifth. The fifth is Wisconsin. For our purposes, Wisconsin is irrelevant. So four teams that David Hale mentioned having won a bowl game and a men's basketball tournament game this year: Alabama, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, and West Virginia. Joe, how many of those teams do you think add a win in the baseball tournament to their scholastic or their athletic resume this year?
Of those four?
Of those four.
Yeah, what were they again? Sorry, one more time.
Alabama, mm-hmm. Oklahoma mm-hmm. State, West Virginia.
I'd say probably two of the four. I think Alabama and Oklahoma State feel like the over-under is 2.5, right?
Because right. That seems pretty clear.
Yeah, so it's like, do you believe enough in West Virginia or Oklahoma? So I would probably go the under there. I'd probably go to Alabama and Oklahoma State. Although I will say just quickly, Oklahoma looked a lot better against Houston this weekend, and it remains to be seen how good Houston is. But it is possible. We tend to sometimes, I'm guilty of this. This is kind of similar to what we talked about with Florida State earlier. Oklahoma's looked so bad in stretches this year. Like, it's easy to kind of write that off as up rebuilding year. And maybe that's true, but it's also possible that they figure things out along the way. So that would be my third. I have a little more confidence in Oklahoma because I like that lineup. If they figure things out on the mound, they could be dangerous. But I'd probably go under. I'd go the two. Oklahoma would be the third if you made me choose a third, I think.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this weekend. Oklahoma plays Texas. We're going to learn a lot, I think, in that series. They're trending in the right way. And as I mentioned, we're going to have a projected field of 64 this week. And like, I've done some thinking about it over the weekend. I haven't put pen to paper yet. But the thing is, Joe, as you'll recall, and I think many of our listeners remember as well, you have to put 64 teams in the NCAA tournament.
That's right. 25 in the top 25, 64 yeah, in the tournament. Yep.
Eight to Omaha.
Yep.
And so you look at it, and you look at our preseason projections. We had 12 SEC teams because I was unwilling to say who I thought really wasn't going to make it, I guess. They're going to have 12 this time. We had four Big Ten teams. One of those is going away. We had, I keep thinking about this and I'm like, well, we're pulling these bids and these bids and these bids. And I'm like, well, where are they all going? They can't all go to Pac-12 teams, which was the one conference that was really underrepresented. Conference USA looks like it's going to be a 2-3 bid, 4 bid, who knows? The Missouri Valley looks like it's going to pick up a bid at least. I can't keep pulling all these teams out. And Oklahoma is now sitting at 12-7. Like, they got some decent wins on the resume. Like, yeah, they looked atrocious that weekend in Frisco, giving up all those runs to Arizona. But, the weekend before in Round Rock, they picked up, a win against Auburn, a win against Baylor. Now they have this sweep of Houston. They beat Arkansas in the midweek. They have a stray win against Mizzou. Like, I mean, they just keep picking up power conference wins, and that's going to work ultimately. Like, I don't know where they're going to finish in the Big 12 standings. That's going to really be a significant determinant in whether they get in or not. But at this point, I'm leaning Oklahoma gets in, and if Oklahoma gets in, probably wins a game. So yeah, I guess right now I would take the over. I don't think all four happen. I'm not that enthused about West Virginia. We haven't been that enthused about West Virginia all season long. They're 8-7, and we'll see. They've lost now back-to-back series against Central Michigan and Coastal. at home. So that's not a great look as you're building a resume. Those are good teams, but losing home series is not what you want to be doing. But again, the Big 12 is going to be significant for them. But yeah, I guess ultimately my answer would be I would go with three of those four.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So it's also a good point about Oklahoma. Just the on-field standpoint, yes, they could figure some things out, but from a resume standpoint, I think sometimes it's easy to overlook some of those, like, how good is Mizzou really? But and the answer is, like, within the SEC, probably not very good. But unless they, you know, really, really bottom out, like, that's still going to be at worst an RPI neutral win. Like, that's not going to hurt them any.
Hard for that not to be a top 100 RPI win.
Exactly.
It's on a neutral site.
Right. So like stuff like that ends up mattering in the end when we start to really look at, okay, team A, Oklahoma, for example, you know, is, you know, 12 and 14 against the top 100, or I guess it'd probably be more games than that, but you know what I mean? Like roughly 500 against the top 100. Then you've got some other team that's, you know, from a smaller conference that's, you know, 4-7 against the top 100. And so those things, those wins against Mizzou, which were kind of like, right now, really do end up mattering when it comes to resume time. So it's a great point.
Well, we'll have plenty of time to dig into resumes as the months continue. And we'll definitely be doing that here on the Baseball America College podcast. So make sure you are subscribed on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us, subscribe, rate, review. We appreciate it all. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy BA. We'll have plenty of content over at baseballamerica.com throughout the week, and we will be back here with another edition of the Baseball America College podcast late this week, probably on Thursday. That's when we usually release our preview for the weekend, when we look at the top series coming up to get you ready for what should be another great weekend of college baseball. This was a fun one. We covered a lot of ground. There's a lot more ground to be covered over on baseballamerica.com, like I mentioned. So if you're looking for more, I would encourage you to check out the website. Thank you again to Rap Soto for presenting the Baseball America College podcast. For Joe, I'm Teddy. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Baseball America College podcast.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.